Today on the West Side, we're happy to welcome two well-known members of Wisconsin's Native communities for a look at some of the latest news and issues that could have a big implication for tribal nations across the state and the state as a whole. So without further ado, let's get to it. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning on Ideas Network stations 88.3 WHWC and 88.7 WRFW. And joining me by phone, I'd like to welcome first Mick Isham. He is the chairman of the Board of Commissioners at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. He's also the former tribal chairman of the Lacoutere Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. Mick Isham, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
It's my pleasure. I'd also like to welcome Paul DeMain. He is the founder, editor, and CEO of the national publication News from Indian Country. He's a member of the United Nations of Ojibwe descent. Paul DeMain, thank you for being on the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rich.
Listeners, we'd like to get you in on this discussion as well. If you've got a question or a comment, please feel free to call us at 1-800-228-5615 with a question or comment. You can also post on the West Side Facebook page if you'd rather not go on the air for whatever reason. I'll do my best to get that question read aloud on the air. So, Paul, you're a longtime newsman, and I'll start with you. Basically, what is the story that's getting the most attention, on your website?
Well, on our website, there's certainly been a lot of activity at our website and elsewhere in regards to things associated with water. Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of discussion and articles about sulfide mines, especially here because of what's occurred in Wisconsin with the lifting of what was the prove it first, or some people called it a moratorium. It wasn't so much a moratorium as it was prove you can do a sulfide mine and open and close it without any long-term environmental damage, which hasn't been done yet, including the Kennecott mine site at Ladysmith. But nevertheless, there was a push to make it easier to get into mining in Wisconsin and to, again, suspend protections over environmental impacts, water quality, the removal and movement of wet streams, which is tied to things like providing huge incentives to foreign-owned companies like Foxconn, because if you're going to waive your environmental rules and regulations over the protection of water and disregard your public trust responsibilities toward water for a foreign corporation like Foxconn, the question is why can't other corporations doing business in the state of Wisconsin have those same types of exemptions from taxes and regulatory authorities? And that, unfortunately, seems to be the way we're moving in this state. The other big issue in our website and a lot of activities has to do with the pipeline issues. There's lots of issues we could talk about in regards to what's happening on a regular basis in Indian Country as a nation or in the state of Wisconsin. Tribal governments have their own agenda in terms of how they're dealing with issues like the budget that's going on in Congress and in Washington, D.C., how that's going to impact the tribes in housing, BIA education, health care, those kinds of tribal services. But on the outside, one of the biggest grassroots activities that's occurring is the opposition to pipelines, whether it's Line 3 in Minnesota, Line 5 in Wisconsin, and the Upper Peninsula and across the Mackinac Straits, the future potential Line 66 running from Superior down to Patoka, Illinois, the XL, Keystone XL, which, of course, the current Keystone pipeline just leaked 250,000 gallons of oil or barrels of oil here about 2 weeks ago. So there's a lot of activity across Indian Country that involves issues of environmental concerns, including, for example, the Trump's administration's attempts to shrink and diminish some of the monuments in national parks and open them up to drilling, mining, and other activities, which are generally opposed from tribes. And in fact, a lot of those monuments and parks were put into trust and set aside simply because they are sites that are environmentally sensitive and archaeologically, historically, culturally, religiously important to those tribes that they're near. So that's that's kind of a short capsulization of what's happening.
A lot to unpack there, and we'll do that. I've got, luckily, I brought up some questions regarding this stuff, but I wanted to go to Mick Isham first. When it comes to Glyphwick, you know, the work that you're doing with them and, you know, LCO News, what are you hearing as top concern, Mick?
Well, again, I got to really commend Paul for doing that all in one breath. That sure is a heck of a lot of stuff going on.
Yes.
And that's if you put your head in a hole, then you don't know about all the things that are going on. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. If you look not just in the States, the Midwest, the country, the world, it's just mind-boggling. It's hard to be an optimist in this day and age. And so... But you still have to try, because we all have kids and grandkids, and that's the most important thing. The environment, our water, and ensuring that that'll be there for the next seven generations. So we can never give up. So, but to tackle more specifically the issues, which is, you know, what your program is about, I think that, you know, in regards to Glyphwick, my duty pretty much lies within the ceded territories first and foremost. So anything that would weaken any environmental regulations or put our treaty-related harvests at risk, that's pretty much what my number one focus has to be. So you're looking at the top third of Wisconsin and also Michigan and Minnesota, northern Michigan and Minnesota. So generally all the things that are affecting that, Paul just, like I said, in one breath, did it all, I think.
Well, let me jump in, and then let's start with, you know, the moratorium law or the repeal of the moratorium law. As you mentioned, Paul, it basically, the law that had been around since, I think it was 1998 in Wisconsin, basically required a mining company that wanted to get a permit to mine for things like gold, silver, copper, vanadium, other metals. They would have to give examples of mines that operated for 10 years without polluting and had been closed for 10 years. It had been on the books, basically. I think a lot of people refer to it as the moratorium law because it. We haven't seen any new mines of that type since Flambeau, which closed, I think, in 1997, which is near Ladysmith, a pretty successful in terms of how much material that was mined out of there.
Sure.
As to whether it's, you know, it's being held as the example from both sides of the argument or the debate here, it's being...
Well, not from the tribal side, I don't believe.
Of course.
I believe it's still leaking copper into the river.
Yeah, DNR, I think it was in 2012, they issued a report that said that there was metals like copper, very high concentrations, coming from a tributary from the property. Of course, there's still debate from, you know, the pro-mining folks say that we don't know where it's coming from, and that's a whole big discussion. But basically, I'm wondering, how would lifting this law, Governor Walker has promised to repeal it, but some are saying that he may be leery of repealing or signing this bill to repeal the law because he voted for it back in 1997. I'm not positive about that, but...
Let me jump in here.
Please, Paul.
He did vote for it when he was in the legislature.
Right. And I think more so than that is the question of whether or not this bill that was passed by the Republican side of the legislature, they control everything in the state legislature, is whether or not it has a social contract in those communities. You saw Cowlis over there in the Green Bay area vote against it, and you have huge opposition to the proposed Back 40 mine on the Menominee River. And so when you hold a hearing in Ladysmith, Wisconsin, to exemplify how wonderful the Kennecott mine opened and closed, you have to remember there's major differences in that they shipped all the ore out of that complex and sent it to Canada for smeltering. So it's very different than what the GTAC mining proposal in the Pinokies was, mm-hmm. And what the Exxon mine would have been in Crandon, and what the Back 40 mine in, on the Menominee River might be, or the Gold Reef mine might be in Marathon County, or the Bend Yellow, which is copper gold, that's another Aquilis in Taylor County, or what the vanadium mine on the Round Lake and that area up there in Sawyer County might look like, because those operations typically are much, much larger operations and deposits and would need to have a fully operation slurry operation in order to extract the remnants of copper, gold, silver, vanadium, or whatever they're looking out of there. So they would be much more extensive mining operations, just from what I know of what's been proposed in the past. So when they had the hearing in Ladysmith, and the first hour was Tom Tiffany testifying on behalf of his own bill, mm-hmm. and the next person was Hutton, who's another co-sponsor, testifying on behalf of his own bill, and then the people that Aquila Mining Company flew in from Canada, Inuit territory, which was a woman who was all for mining for her Indian community without any of the empowerment nodes that she noted to Tiffany, and that was is that those tribes voted to pass the legislation. They control the government. Mm-hmm. They were at the table, unlike this particular bill that Tiffany said he had no responsibility to consult with any of the tribal governments in Wisconsin. He said that's not his job to consult with his constituents in northern Wisconsin, apparently. So he said that he didn't need to invite tribal governments or Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission and those kinds of entities to this hearing. The hearing was certainly stacked in terms of the first hour and a half, where all you heard was pro-mining stuff, and then you heard a geologist talk about how northern Wisconsin had 15 deposits of rare minerals, and all we'd have to do is lift this law, and all these mines will then get permitted, and 40,000 people will move into northern Wisconsin, and everyone will have jobs, and they'll drive BMWs, and they'll have pearls around their neck and diamond rings on their fingers, and everyone will be happy, happy, happy. That's a reality that's built around some other kind of conception that doesn't exist in the northern Wisconsin that I know, where communities are concerned about tourism, consumers and tourists and indigenous people and hunters and fishermen are concerned about clean water and clean deer and clean frogs that don't have two heads and those kinds of things. So there's a disconnect between the reality of northern Wisconsin and the legislators in Madison who are trying to make it some kind of an industrial zone that'll create jobs and benefit the state of Wisconsin and the people that live there and are impacted by these environmental impacts.
Does the repeal of this mining moratorium law, let's just call it that to keep one term, because a lot of people call it many different things. Does the repeal of the law that has kept sulfide mining operations out, does that by itself, or does the proposed projects in parts of northern Wisconsin pose a threat to tribal sovereignty? Mick Isham?
Well, certainly.
And with regard to the ceded territories and the right to manage water and all the other resources.
Well, certainly under Le Coudray versus Wisconsin, of which Le Coudray won the case, they talk about that the state doesn't have the ability to legislate away our treaty rights, but they also don't have unfettered, they just can't do with the land what they want, which would have the same effect of getting rid of our treaty rights. Paul was talking about all the major differences between the projects, all the various projects that are going on. And there's another major difference, and that's in the way the tribes look at environmental degradation. We talked about the Ladysmith mine, and it's still leaking copper, but yet those people from the DNR or from the sportsman groups or the mining industry, they use this as this shining example of how it can be done right. But there's such a major difference in how we look at it. So if you're just a sport hunter or a sport fisherman, and you're just getting a muskie and then releasing it, or maybe two fish or whatever that may be, sport-related, then yeah, you can have copper in the fish or mercury in the fish. But if you're subsisting on it, like the tribes do, you know, just like they harvest their corn and put it away in a silo, and we do that same thing with the fish. The tribes are much more susceptible to environmental contamination than the general public because we subsist on so much of the natural resources. So that's the major difference there. And so if they're not going to hear that side of the story, they're not going to come up and consult with the tribes, then they're certainly not going to understand it. Not that they would listen in the first place. Well, there I go getting pessimistic again. I'm trying to remain optimistic.
Right.
But when Paul was naming all those projects, it was like, wow. We just don't seem to learn from the past. You know, when Lake Erie's on fire and all these things, when the eagles were on the endangered list and the causes for all this stuff, we know what the issue is, but then we repeat it and repeat it and repeat it. And then the other thing I think that's worth noting here is all those separate projects Paul mentioned, they take them as separate projects. They'll hold a hearing here in Ladysmith on Ladysmith Mine. They'll hold a hearing over there in Menominee or Marinette on the Back 40 Mine and GTAC up in Ashland. And they take every single project separately. But in reality, all these things have accumulative effects. Everything should start being looked at that way. You know, my friend Mike Wiggins in Bad River, I remember years ago, said death of a thousand pinpricks. These things are happening not just here. They're happening all around Lake Superior, Canada, everywhere. And we got to start looking at things in a holistic approach instead of separating them out. Because that's, in the long run, what's really degrading everything.
And Paul DeMaine, if I could go back to you, I read a piece that was written by Al Geddix and Dave Bluen, two longtime anti-mining people and pro-environmental advocates, and they mentioned something about tribes having authority under the Clean Water Act to protect wild rice from mining pollution. He was talking specifically about the Crannon situation. But do any of that long list of projects that you've mentioned, which I'm not sure how far along they are, but they have been, there has been discussion about them in all those different counties. Would any of those threaten that authority?
Well, you know, the thing is that there's a lot of different authorities out there. I mean, there's in Wisconsin, there was always this notion that there was a public trust towards water.
Sure.
But if you have a governor and if you have a Senate and Assembly that are continuously passing laws that erode the ability to uphold that public trust, and you have an agency where basically you can go online and ask, you know, and fill out your permit to have a mine or whatever it might be nowadays. It's all automated and there's no science behind it, and it's like fill out your own form, you know, let us know how you're going to protect the water and protect the air and all that. You've basically neutered the agency locally in its capability to do its job of ensuring that the environment is pristine and regulations are abided by. There's all these self-reporting things that are going on nowadays, and there's a real concern. Duplicate that a second time by going to Washington, D.C., and a Trump administration who is willing to, for example, sign off on the Keystone XL project, even though people have been fighting that for years, and there's questions about whether they even need it from an economic point of view and what the impact is on tar sands and fracking and the fossil fuel industry and global warming and climate change and all those kinds of things. It's difficult to get those types of laws enforced when agencies aren't willing to step up or don't have the money or the capability to step up because they've been defunded. And therefore, you ask the question, where are the pressure points? if you can't, if the people in Madison, if Senator Tiffany says he has no responsibility to consult with tribal governments on the, you know, over environmental projects that are going to impact the environment in which tribal interests own a 50% resource take interest and an interest to keep those resources clean, where do you put the pressure points? Do you do it in protests like at the Cannonball that took place last year over pipelines and are likely on Line 3 next summer if Minnesota approves that line? Or is it in a lobbying when you're not even, you don't have a seat at the table? I mean, you can, you, Aquila Mining Company can fly in tribal representatives for Inuit or Nunavut, Canada, all bought and paid for, and yet Wisconsin citizens are given, what, 3 or 4 days notice, and tribal governments aren't even invited to participate in how that law might look or why they might oppose something or some things that there might be in favor. So when you say Al Geddes and other people are anti-mining, I'm not quite sure that they're all anti-mining. I think what they're concerned about is the impacts of those mining, because there are mining techniques that have to do with shaft mining and other kind of mining projects that come closer to being environmental friendly and may be necessary. But the question is when we get to sulfide, acid sulfide mining processes that have huge slurry ponds, go to Google Earth and look at Tilden, Michigan, and see what the area looks like. It's a great big orange sludge pond that's 3 or 4 stories high. And if there had been a slurry pond in the Pinoki Range last summer on July 11th, when, you know, anywhere from 11 to 17 inches of rain fell, and all the 500 and 1,000-year bridge projects in northern Wisconsin were blown out on 13 and Highway 2 and Bad River Reservation basically became an island for a while, the fears about the impact of that GTAC mine all came true in one storm caused by global warming and climate change, which scientists have been saying these storms are going to get worse and worse and worse. So, you know, some of the concerns we have are things that are very, very legitimate. But when you ask the question, how do we protect our resources in northern Wisconsin in the face of that onslaught, it's got to be everything. It's just got to be citizens standing up. And it's in, like, over in the Back 40 area, county after county, city councils, townships, and everything else are passing resolutions against this, which means that indeed that's a Republican turf area in that. And if people are opposing the Back 40 mine when they have an opportunity to have an acid sulfide acid mining project, it may be that that may be more of the reason that Walker is hesitating to sign that bill, because that there is legislative support for it, for jobs, 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 jobs. It sounds good, but when you get on the ground and ask people in Marathon County, do you want to mine at the Dells? You know, do you want to mine on the Tiger Cat Flowage? Do you want to mine in your backyard? Everyone seems to say, no, we don't want that here. We want it somewhere else.
And with an election coming up, that could definitely make things tricky for the governor. And it'll be interesting to see when or if he makes a decision. I'd like to go to the phones now, gentlemen. We've got Willem in Colfax. Willem, are you still there?
Yes.
What's on your mind, Willem?
Well, I wanted to agree with so much that's been said, but one of the things that, you know, Tom Tiffany, I think it has to be stated, and it's clear in all his actions, doesn't work for the people of Wisconsin. He works for the contributors to his political campaign, the mining industry, and that's who he's working for. That's why he keeps coming up with new and clever ways to take away local control. And the other thing about the mine, they always refer to this Flambeau mine, but that's not the kind of mine they're talking about. That material was hauled away and processed somewhere else. What they're talking about is a whole different kind of mine. So they keep pointing to an irrelevant project. And about the jobs, if this is such a great job creator, then why isn't Ladysmith a hopping little town? Why isn't New Auburn a booming community, you know, surrounded by sand mines? The truth of the matter is that the material leaves the state, the money leaves the state, and if you look at the industry's own publications, they're moving toward automation. Somebody in a room controlling the machinery by computer, by robotics, that's the future of mining. It's not going to, and I think that as far as the Republicans like to make a lot about their moral authority, but what about the morality of leaving our children and future generations an environment that they can actually live in? What about the morality of that?
Excellent point there, Willem. Let's go to our guests, either one, Paul DeMaine or Mick Isham.
Well, I'm going to jump in here because I have the most experience in my job in dealing with the Flambeau mine. I was on that one back for many years as a council member, and my son, his on his mom's side, his family is from Ladysmith.
Mm-hmm.
And so during that whole time, they were pro-mine. And the number one thing that made them pro the Ladysmith mine was the jobs, jobs, jobs. And this caller here made an excellent point. You know, Ladysmith is pretty much, I wouldn't call it a boom town, let's just say that. But so this jobs, jobs, jobs argument, they came in, and what they did is they basically brought their people from other places, Michigan or Minnesota. No one locally did get any jobs. And so now when I talk to the in-laws on that side, they're mad about that. They feel duped. And I think these stories are the ones that are really important to get out because none of them did get the jobs. They also said they were going to be there for so many years, but they went in, got it, and they left as soon as they could.
I think it was expedited. The vein was real rich, and I remember speaking with Al Christensen, who was the administrator there in Ladysmith, said that it was something like four or five years that they mined, which pretty brief in the large scope of things. We need to take a break, gentlemen. I'm speaking with Paul DeMaine. He's founder and editor and CEO of the national publication News from Indian Country. He's a member of the Oneida Nation with Ojibwe descent. Mick Isham is the chairman of the Board of Commissioners at the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. He's former tribal chairman and board member at the Lac-Couturier Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. We're talking about issues affecting, well, the entire state, but we're getting some tribal perspective on some of these issues, including mining proposals, the potential repeal of a 20-year-old law known as the sulfide mining moratorium. We're going to talk about pipelines. We've already done that a little bit. Enbridge pipelines coming through, existing in Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin, and more are on the radar. If you've got a question or a comment, give us a call at 800-228-5615. This is The West Side. We'll be right back.
Wait, wait, don't tell me. Central Time. These programs and many more are possible thanks to listener support. You can learn about WPR programs, schedules, and so much more at WPR.org. Thank you. Support also comes from Neff's Pianos in Eau Claire, announcing a holiday event the week of December 4th, featuring new Kingsburg pianos. Open for extended hours, with appointments available at neffspianos.com.
You're listening to The West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this Monday morning. We're talking about issues facing tribal nations in Wisconsin, and joining us for the hour is Mick Isham and Paul DeMaine. Mick Isham is the chairman of the Board of Commissioners for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. He's a former tribal chairman of the Lac-Couturier Band of Lake Superior Chippewa Indians. Paul DeMaine is founder, editor, and CEO of national publication News from Indian Country, member of the Oneida Nation of Ojibwe descent. 1-800-228-5615. Very briefly, I wanted to talk about the Back 40 mine. This is a project, of course, that is in Michigan, right along the border of the Menominee River, which intersects Michigan's Upper Peninsula and Wisconsin. So in a nutshell, the Michigan regulators, I think, have given the green light to this project. As you both have mentioned, there's been a lot of communities on the Wisconsin side of the border, tribal and non-tribal, that have opposed the project. So,
well, they're going through the last. This is Paul.
Yeah, yeah. We got the Army Corps process.
They have to provide a wetland permit, so those hearings are coming up. But for the most part, all the other background permits are in place, but they don't have their social license, which is very important as well. And that project is on the Menominee River. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin has not been involved with it. They basically threw everything. And here's where you have a weak DNR that doesn't do its job. It simply said, we'll let Michigan do all the analysis about water and wetlands impacts, even though those impacts could be on the Wisconsin side. But you want to know that the Upper Peninsula is simply known as an industrialized mining district already, and so it has a very, very pro-mining nature and attitude because of the employment opportunities from history that have taken place up there. But they also have and are paying the price for the biggest impacts from all the slurry ponds and everything. Like I said, look at the Marquette, Tilden area and begin looking at water quality issues and those, and you can see that the impact of the environment has been drastic over time up there. So with the Back 40 mining project in Wisconsin not saying anything, the tribes has basically said, we're getting ready to think about Sioux if the federal government doesn't get involved in some of the permitting processes. But they've also worked with a lot of local people to deprive Aquila's mining company of the social license. And you need a social license to operate nowadays. That means is the community. If the community is hostile to an operation, it's probably never going to go in. And I think that's where the opposition to this, because that was their historic homeland there. When you go on that mining site, there are mounds, there's burial grounds, there's village artifacts, there's a 8 mile by a half mile wide traditional raised garden bed that was there one time. There's a lot of stuff that was there due to the Menominee presence all the way up into the 1850s and 60s when they began to remove to their current location on the Wolf River. That's their historic site. And I don't think you even begin to see the battles that the Menominees are going to put up to preserve their historic homelands. This is where their origin stories come from, is right there where this proposed mine, which wants to shaft mine underneath the Menominee River. And I think that the potential impacts in that area are far greater than what the public has been able to see to date so far.
And won't your news outlet be broadcasting some kind of event from the Menominee Nation on Wednesday?
We'll be going to the College of the Menominee Nation from 6 to 8 p.m. To take place to watch a organizing meeting there. Yes, they've actually had to change the room to a much larger forum because of the number of people who've expressed interest in that, but that's to prepare for petitions and responses and to organize people in opposition of it. So that live stream is at IndianCountryTV.com or at livestream/IndianCountryTV and is available. It's being distributed pretty widely on Facebook, so if people want to look in on that, you have several speakers from the Menominee Nation, and maybe even from the Front 40 operation, which is quite a few non-Native people have been fighting this mine for a number of years. I was surprised at the number of people involved. The atmosphere between Menominee, Michigan, and up in Iron County are very drastically. When we went into Iron County, you had a lot of pro-mining people. When you go over into that area, there's a lot of opposition to it in terms of signs on waterfront, people concerned about their value of their real estate and the potential impact on the Menominee River and the water aquifers of that area.
Yeah, and I concur with that. My family has a cabin east of Amberg, Wisconsin, right near the Menominee River.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a chat room or a Facebook page that people from the area have, a Marinette Menominee mm-hmm. Facebook page, and you know, it's kind of a closed page, and you have to be from the area pretty much to get invited to that page, and I'm part of that. And the opposition to this mine, I have not seen any arguments for it. Of course, that doesn't mean that there aren't people for it, but and the discussion on Republican versus Democrat, really, this kind of throws out that line, because as Paul mentioned, there's a big Republican area there. And I think part of the discussion is that we need to stop this division, because it's more about what you know, individually and all the things. Again, my family from Ladysmith there, they also identify as being Republican. And I see throughout the state here, throughout the country, it seems like we focus on this division all the time. And even though we point out issue after issue after issue that we may agree on, but yet I'm a Republican, I'm a Democrat, that keeps us divided. And I think we really have to focus on, no matter what, find out what we have in common as people and work on what we have in common instead of these divisions, because these divisions lead to nothing but these violent protests that we're starting to see everywhere.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got two callers that have been waiting for a while. Lynn and Eau Claire, are you there?
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
I have a son, an adapted son, Neil Dajbik Bearhart, who is from Maple Plain. And as soon as we realize that what happens there happens to their white Republican neighbors, too, that when you keep an indigenous population down and you keep them poor and you keep them undereducated and unhealthy, that seeps through the entire society at large. That is a condemnation on us all, and we cannot allow that to happen. We can't allow it to happen. We want people to be politically active, politically involved, but if you don't invite them to the table, they're not going to be there. And I applaud what you gentlemen are doing.
Thank you for the call, Lynn. I appreciate that. 800-228-5615. Paul DeBain, Mick Isham, any reaction?
Well, real quickly, I think that, again, what Mick had said earlier about getting rid of the Republican and Democrat designations, I think that's true when we come to asking the question, what is it that we want for northern Wisconsin? Do we want, some short-term gain that maybe puts some money in my back pocket? Or are we looking at being here another 400 or 500 years, like the Ojibwe people have been here for 1,000 of years? Nobody's moving out of this area. This is their home. This is where their ancestors are buried. And so if we want our grandchildren, your grandchildren, my grandchildren, to be able to live here, we need to provide a clean environment. We need to find environmentally friendly jobs rather than extractive jobs that take the value and resources out of our community and wreck other things in the process, but leave us devastated. You know, the Pinoki Range at one point was mined very heavily, and if you go up there, all the schools are gone, the villages and cities are gone, because the industry came and left with it. And the Ojibwe people are still here, and there's a handful of people who've been here forever that are still here. What brings us together? What makes life worth living for? It's not always how much money you can make, but the quality of being able to go out your front door and to go fishing and to go hunting and to gather and to breathe fresh air. That's part of the values that we have in northern Wisconsin.
Now, we've got another caller, Linda in Birchwood. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I have been paying attention to what's been going on in our area with pipelines,
mm-hmm.
and I'm looking at some of the decisions the Bad River local, tribal government has made versus LCO,
mm-hmm.
and in light of looking at things holistically for future generations and working together, maybe one of your guests could help explain how LCO government arrived at their decision and whether membership was invited to the table to help come up with that decision.
All right. Thanks so much for that, Linda. 800-228-5615. Mick Isham, I believe that's a question to you. Of course, you weren't involved with tribal government, I don't think, but there was an agreement made between the Lacouture Band and Enbridge on a renewal of some sort?
Yes. As tribal chairman, we knew that these easements were coming up for renewal. And Enbridge did approach us, and they wanted to initiate talks in regards to the renewal of these easements. Meanwhile, they were also getting permits and everything ready for, I guess, in case the tribe did not renew the easements like Bad River, and they have a corridor that basically goes right around the reservation, right around the western corner of the reservation, which is exactly what happened when we denied the Arrowhead to Weston power, high transmission power line several years back. They just went right around the reservation. So I can't speak for the LCO Tribal Governing Board, and I think they would have to contact them directly to get their statements in regards to that. However, I think that the thinking that goes into this, because there's a lot of stuff that goes into this. So if the easements were denied and one thinks that there's no real way to stop the entire project and they're just going to go right around the reservation, then you have to look at which the groundwater flows and what the impacts are and things like that. And if I recall correctly, if they use that same corridor that the Arrowhead to Weston power lines used, I believe that the water flows from there onto the reservation.
It does.
And so it's possible that the thinking is if they deny them the permits and they go around, there is more reservation that is at risk than what is at risk with the current pipeline as it is. But I say that, you know, I can't say for the tribe.
Right.
To contact the tribe directly. And as far as the membership being involved, I'm not exactly aware of all the hearings that were held. I believe there was a couple informational hearings, but there was no referendum or anything like that.
That's right. Let me take a quick stab at it.
Sure,
as well.
Sure. Paul DeMaine.
Having worked with the tribe and as part of honor being on the team that organizes against these pipelines, against Line 3, the decommissioning of Line 5, being opposed to Line 66, which would run from Superior to Patoka, Illinois in the future, I think what the tribe lacked was an ability to roll this out in a proper way. A year ago, the tribe passed a three-page resolution in support of Standing Rock against fossil fuels, talked about environmental concerns, talked about values for the future and several generations, and sent that as a resolution of support with tribal members and veterans and elders and other people out to Cannonball to stand against the Dakota Access. A year later, the tribe announces that it has a $60 to $70 million agreement with Enbridge and waited a week before they put out their press release. Rather than saying they stand with the Bad River Ojibwe people and support them in their want to decommission Line 5, rather than saying that they stand with the Chippewa tribes of Minnesota in their support of opposition to Line 3, which is going to go through a lot of ricin beds, rather than saying they don't think they need a new Twin Line 66 through Wisconsin for tar sands and fracked oil, what they did is they announced that, oh, we got a lot of money out of them, but they didn't get it now. They've got it in payments. Oh, they're paying us for historical stuff. Well, then it should have been a check given to you for historical easement flows through the reservation. Rather than talking about those values, because I always thought the tribe would come to a settlement. Every tribe other than Bad River has come to a settlement and then utilize those monies for needed things on the reservation, like the conversion to solar energy and getting tribal government off of the fossil fuels. Rather than saying something about global warming, rather than saying something that said we still have environmental values, but we were between a rock and a hard spot and a conundrum, because if we had said no, we wouldn't have got any money. The easements would have gone off the reservation, and they would have created a larger endangerment zone, just like with the Bad River Line 5. If Enbridge decides to go around the reservation, you more than quadruple the amount of pipeline exposure into the reservation rather than through Highway 2. So it didn't surprise me that the tribe settled. It surprised me that we got reminded by one of the council members that we drove cars Well, I wouldn't have known that. I didn't know that. You know, there was no recognition of people getting off the grid, no recognition of people using less gas by more efficient cars, by building differently. It was like we made a settlement, we got a lot of money, and now we got to start handing it out, you know, elderly per capitas and programs to get people fighting about the money. So I was disappointed in how the settlement came about more than that it happened.
That's I got to jump in here again. I think there's a couple points there that we really have to, look at. And, I mean, I was on when we passed that resolution. I was chairman at the time and sent people to Standing Rock. And I knew that other tribes were settling, as Paul said. And so I was trying to educate myself on the different ways that the tribe were dealing with Enbridge. And I believe it was Red Lake that took the, they did settle, and they were using the payments to do a solar farm. And I think that's really where we have to go. Paul said that a council member said, yeah, we drive cars. And that's a fact. When we did the Arrowhead Weston power lines and we were doing the hearings, I got put on the stand there, and the company said, do you have a casino? And I said, yes. Dude, does it use electricity? Yes. No further questions. And so I guess my point is that we really do have to look at that side of it. We are consumers, and, you know, I get teased a little bit about my manly Prius that I have and drive, but I think we really have to look at things and lessening our impacts and look at solar and everything. I also serve on the Great Lakes Advisory Board, and we make recommendations for how to use the appropriations for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And at the Water Summit in Ashland at Northland College, we talked a lot about GLRI. And afterwards, there was a little get-together, and there was a student from Northland saying, you environmental guy, but he had to take, there should be zero money given for restoration. All those hundreds of millions of dollars should be used to start converting every single city, Milwaukee, Chicago, to solar panels on houses, and the infrastructure for all that, because what's the use of restoring something if we're going to not learn from that and then go pollute here, back 40, and all these other places? So that's really, I think, the kind of thinking that we have to start promoting and look at local power generation and some of the things Paul was saying, because, yes, we use electricity and we do use cars.
Other than the issues with regard to fossil fuels and energy, there's plenty of other issues that have come up. One has to do with the wolves and the management in Wisconsin. There's a group of northern Wisconsin Republicans, Senator Tom Tiffany, State Representative Adam Jarko, Mary Filskowski, who's a state representative, and Romaine Quinn, who's a state representative as well. Basically, in a nutshell, these four have put forth a bill that would block the DNR or any law enforcement in the state from investigating illegally killed wolves. It would also block resources from being used to enforce federal wolf protections or any kind of federal management. I just wanted to make Isham, you and I talked about this on this program back when Wisconsin was going through the motions to create a wolf hunting season. And I think at the time you mentioned something about, you know, are these people going to, you know, planning on eating the wolves? What are they hunting them for? Is it sport or whatever? But what's your reaction to this bill that would basically tell the folks in the state to just let anything go with regard to wolves? They want to pressure the Congress to take the wolf off of the endangered species list. So your thoughts?
Well, I don't know if that will have that effect of getting them to take it off the endangered species list. It just seems to me it would make it more important for the tribes and the feds to manage the wolves. Mm-hmm. But, you know, some of this stuff really amazes me. I mean, it reminds me a little bit about desegregation, and while we're not going to, this is federal law, but we're not going to enforce it in all the stuff down south that was happening with schools, and it just amazes me how we don't seem to learn from history. But wolves are so critical to our ecosystem, and I've said it many times that, you know, this chronic wasting disease, I'm not sure if it would be here if we had a healthy population of wolves. Maybe it would be here, but it certainly would have slowed it. And wolves are critical, and they're needed badly, in my opinion, as a biologist.
Whether the bill goes anywhere, it remains to be seen. It'll be interesting. There's also news of the DNR has changed, created a rule proposal that could lead to a limited elk hunt for bull elk in specific parts, in areas, you know, that could affect the Clam Lake herd and the Black River Falls herd. Any thoughts on that, either one of you?
Well, I've been involved with the elk reintroduction pretty much since the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm 100% in favor of it. At the time, I remember there were hearings and there were people saying elk were never here, but of course, we all know that's not true. And we had elders from our tribe testifying about all the elk stories and things like that. But I'm in favor of establishing this elk herd. And, you know, the tribes have harvested an elk and are looking at possibly doing another ceremonial elk hunt. But as far as the hunting goes, we pretty much had an agreement that said once the herd got to 200 animals, then there would be a limited hunt. And I'm talking about the Clam Lake herd here, mm-hmm. because then when it was reaching 200 animals, they abruptly stopped. They were going to bring in some other elk from Kentucky and supplement the herd because of the genetics aspect of it. But they stopped that and then put a herd down in Black River Falls area. And I suspect it was so that the herd up here didn't reach the agreed-upon 200 animals so the tribe couldn't hunt them.
I'm sorry, Mick. We're running out of time. I apologize for asking that question with so little to go. But I want to thank both of you so much for joining us. Mick Isham is chairman of the Board of Commissioners for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, former tribal chairman for the Lacouture Band of Lake Superior Chippewa. Paul DeMaine is founder, editor, and CEO of national publication News from Indian Country. He's also a member of the United Nations with of Ojibwe descent. I'm Rich Kramer. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next Monday morning.
Thank you.
Thank you.